listening to another episode of Lords of Limited with your hosts Ben Wernie and Ethan Sachs.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Wernie, and joining me on the line, fresh out of bed at his parents' house, we have Ethan Sachs.
Well, there's no place like home for the holidays. Yeah, buddy, I'm living the dream. I'm playing Magic in my parents' basement as a 30-year-old.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Yeah, I came home to New Jersey, spent some time with my parents before Christmas, so if you hear any ambient noise, it's like the furnace, it's them rustling around upstairs, so just lock in for a fun day at the Saxes. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I stayed up till 4 a.m. last night streaming. We had some viewer hype. I was riding about 200 viewers for, you know, 4 or 5 hours there towards the end once Caleb and LSV got off, and woke up this morning at 9 a.m., played some table tennis, and I am fired up and ready to go.
The question that everyone wants to know is, did you win at the table tennis, the sports tennis?
The sports tennis? Did mostly win at the sports tennis, yes.
Oh, nice.
Won more than I lost. I was actually a 66% win rate. I won. We played doubles with four people, and we rotate. So two of the people I won with, one of the people I lost with.
Nice. Well, we've got a lot of housekeeping to get through today at the start of the show. And the first thing that we want to discuss is our very exciting Patreon page. Yes, that's right. We do have a way to support the show. Patreon.com/Lords of Limited is a way for you to give back to the show monetarily if you so choose. The show will always be free, but we give you a little bit of some perks, like getting access to our show notes, getting access to a little pre-show recording, and more importantly, getting a shout out on the show. So we wanted to thank our new patrons this week, Adrian, Norman, Sean, and Han. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for your support. It means the world to us.
Yes, cannot say thank you enough. We really, really, really appreciate it. We also have our XLN treasure hunt ended on December 20th. So we are going to wrap that up here and do our giveaway. So yeah. We only had one person do more than five, and that person was Generation D20. However, he crushed it, got 17 out of the 18 achievements on his own, which is absolutely insane. The only one he did not get was Give Me Your Loot. That was stealing something your opponent controls with Admiral Beckett Brass. Everything else he crossed off, which is awesome. Thank you so much for doing the Treasure Hunt Generation D20. Tons of fun. Really appreciate you supporting it. And quickly, I want to run through everyone else that participated and how many achievements they got. Strix Familiar, 2 achievements. Crash of Rhinos, 2 achievements. Rosa 2058, 1 achievement. Sparrow's Rum, another streamer. Crash of Rhinos also streams. Sparrow's Rum, 1 achievement. Lord Tupperware also got more than 5, but he's not eligible, so he's not getting any giveaways. He got 7, LT, 7, DC Sports 8, 3, Ehedude, 3, myself, 3, Mr. Ducky, 1, D-Shiles, 2, and Master Jareth, 1.
Nice. Thanks, everyone, for participating. That was super fun to see on Twitter.
Yeah, that was awesome. Like, especially the first 3 weeks when everyone was, like, posting them. Like, I just kept logging onto Twitter because I wanted to see more screenshots.
Yeah.
Super cool. Since Generation D20 was the only one that got 5 or more, he's going to get all 4 draft sets of Ixalan from us. So congratulations, Generation D20, and thank you so much for your support of the podcast.
Yeah, for sure. So that also means that we are going to be doing our 18-hour stream. We've set a date, Wednesday, December 27th, from 8 a.m. to 2 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. The front 9 hours are going to be on my channel, twitch.tv/LordTupperware. The last 9 hours are going to be on Mr. Metronome's channel, twitch.tv/MrMetronome. So please, please come hang out with us. It's going to be an extremaganza.
Yes, and we also have a huge perk for you. We had a very generous donation from one of our listeners of the podcast of Power 9 to the show. So we're going to be doing a giveaway during the 18-hour stream, and we're going to be doing a giveaway every 2 hours, one of the 9 pieces of power. So come hang out, and you will be eligible for a chance to win. We hope to see you there.
Yeah, and we also have something very exciting for the show today. We have a guest, our first ever guest with both Lords of Limited hosts on. You may have seen him lurking or instructing in our Twitch chats. You may have seen his amazing articles on Star City Games. We'd like to give a warm Lords of Limited welcome to Ryan Sachs. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys.
Hey, man. It's good to have you. You're all done with finals now, yeah?
Finally, yeah. It was a brutal couple weeks, but Moto is reinstalled, and we've been cubing a lot, yeah.
Excellent. Well, we should dive into the trophy leaderboard update before we get into our exciting show with you. Ben, how have the mean streets of Vintage Cube been treating you?
Yeah, started off a little rocky. Some 2-1 finals losses, and then a couple 1-2s, and then pulled out 2 trophies. and then I drafted a very sweet Storm deck that was way too much deck for me to handle. One-2'd with that, and then I 1-2'd the deck that we drafted together on stream last night. So I have 2 trophies in 9 drafts, a couple other finals appearances, a 16-11 record for a 59% overall win rate.
Nice. I have not gotten to cube that much, it looks like. I've only gotten 6 drafts under my belt, 2 trophies, so a 13-5 record, 72% win rate.
Can we just pause for a second and let the world know that I have currently done more drafts in a format than the great Ethan Sachs? That has never happened before on this podcast.
That's true. That's true. We can compare our Ixalan numbers. You have 92 drafts. I have 200. I didn't even update this. I think it's like 220 now or something.
Jesus, you're a monster.
Drafted that format more than anyone on this planet, I think. Ryan, how about you? You have any sweet tales of Cube or updates to the trophy leaderboard?
For Cube, I believe I have 2 trophies. I'm not exactly sure my exact win rate. I've done about 7 drafts. I think it would be like 14-7. I've been doing a lot of 2-1s, and I think I have the same number of trophies as I have 1-2s, so should be an exact even split. But as far as like tails, probably one of my favorite Cube moments actually happened already. I posted this to Twitter. I had a Consecrated Sphinx, and my opponent had a Consecrated Sphinx, and I cast Emrakul the Promised End, took their turn, and made them draw their deck.
Oh, that's dirty.
Yeah, that is filthy.
That was sweet.
Ben, what did you do with a mind-slavered opponent?
we double achievemented in one game. I mind-slavered my opponent, ultimated their own Liliana, and targeted them with it, made them sacrifice all their permanents, so they had no board. And then and we had the mind-slaver lock, so they quit after that, but we also had enough mana to do the mind-slaver lock, so won the game with opponent controlling no permanents, and we got the Mindslaver Lock achievement crossed off.
Cube is wonderful.
All this Vintage Cube talk is reminding me of something very exciting that happened for the podcast a couple days ago, which was that our 25th episode, Vintage Cube Crash Course, was featured on the Mothership, was featured on dailymtg.com. So thank you to whoever out there made that decision and put it on there. I know Blake Rasmussen is the editor-in-chief, so if he's the one to thank you, Blake. If someone gave it Blake's way, then thank you to that person. And hopefully we're welcoming a few new listeners, so hopefully we outlined some good things about Cube for you last week, and we want to see your degenerate screenshots on Twitter or in our email or wherever you so choose to put those. We're really excited to see what gross things people are doing with this powered Cube this season.
Absolutely.
So, Ryan, for those who don't know you or don't know the articles that you write on Star City Games or don't know your incredible advice that you can provide people in Twitch chat, can you perhaps give a little bit of background on your history with the game?
Sure. Like most people, I've come to Magic in patches. So I started about 11 years ago around Cold Snap, which was just at, you know, I went to sleepaway camp and people played Magic there. My parents sent me an Auroch starter deck, which is like a sort of green tribal creatures. And I got hooked pretty quickly. Played casually up until about college when I found out my roommate played. Started going to a local game store. That's when I got introduced to drafting. And if anybody knows me, that's about all I do now. So it sort of progressed with a break here or there. I took a break, you know, in high school to college. And then I started actually playing way, way too much at one point in college and had to take a break for a couple months again. And when I really got into Magic, so after all the, you know, playing with friends, casual, when I started, you know, going to GPs, PPTQs, RPTQs and so on, would have been around Shadows over Innistrad, was when I would say that's when I sort of first leveled up, which isn't actually that long ago. And it's actually directly correlated with me installing Magic Online, which, just because I got to, play at such a higher frequency. From there, I just started making friends. Actually, I think that's what I'm most thankful for in Magic, is that I've jumped from friend group to friend group of people who play this game, and you meet so many interesting people. Everybody has their own story, their job, their interests, and you really get to grow as a person through interacting with other people. And so that's sort of like the background with the game. And then what I really enjoy now, even more than playing, is probably writing. So I started writing articles for a website that is run by someone at NYU, actually. It's called spellsnare.com. And I started, I think, about a year and a half ago, just writing articles. I thought it would be fun, and I really, really enjoyed it. It got me thinking in a really intense way about the game, where I sort of had to understand what I was doing and why I was doing it. From there, I just eventually moved to Star City because they found one of my articles through a friend who used to write for Star City. And the rest is history. I've just been writing for them for about a year now, and I love it.
That's awesome. That's great. So you have a lot of really interesting articles that have appeared on Star City Games. Your most recent one is sort of the spark for this episode about drafting with preferences. Can you outline that concept for our listeners?
Yeah, for sure. It's probably my favorite concept in drafting, and it's the idea that you should actually embrace your own biases. So a lot of people will tell you, oh, you bias towards control or you bias towards aggro. It's really important to understand that so that you can suppress it. That's what people will tell you, because you should always draft properly, draft what's open, draft what you're supposed to draft. And while there's certainly merit there, I'm not advocating hard forcing any strategies, you have a bias towards aggressive decks because you enjoy playing them and you're good at playing them. And you can alter the way that you draft because you're simply more likely to end up in an aggressive deck if you like aggressive decks. So you change the way that you draft, not to guarantee you end up within that strategy, but just to make it more likely that you play the cards that you pick.
Yeah, and so this would be what you were talking about, where you're staying open and drafting perfectly. That would be like there's a really famous article by Ben S. called Drafting the Hard Way, right?
Wonderful article.
It's awesome. Fantastic article. We can link it in the show notes. That would be like drafting the perfect way. And then you're talking about biasing. And I think this is one of, like, hanging out with you and interacting with you on Twitch is one of the biggest ways I've leveled up, is I've started to embrace this concept of drafting with preferences. For example, I think that's why I've done so well in Ixalan. Like, once we did the Beard episode and I started slanting my picks towards drafting aggro, drafting one with the wind, and really wanting to end up in aggro. If you do that, like, we're not full forcing, but if you bias your picks that way, it makes it much more likely, if, like, in a format, you can identify what the optimal strategy is and then bias towards that optimal strategy, I think your win rate's going to go up.
I agree. It's what I do in most formats, is trying figuring out the overlap between what's good, what I like, and how exactly I can shift the way that I draft to increase the probability that I end up in a deck that meets that overlap.
Yeah, it's really smart. I'm going to second Ben's point about it being a huge level up for me. One of the things that I really appreciated, and we've talked about this on the show before, but specifically from you and from Sasha, also known as Dude on Twitch, and Panda the Nice One on Twitter, that both of you guys are very fluid in your evaluations of draft picks. It's very subjective, not objective, which is a breath of fresh air in the Magic community. It feels like there's a lot of black and white, right and wrong in terms of pick orders and what is correct to take in a draft. And both of you guys have a very different approach, and it's always, in my opinion, this is right, but, like, this comes down to preference, or sometimes people will post deck lists and we're trying to figure out the 22nd, 23rd card or what to cut. And you're always just like, this just comes down to preference. So it feels like you're very aware at multiple stages of the draft how personal preference comes into play with, like, picking these final cards.
Absolutely. I think that personally, I had a very similar level up to exactly what you're describing, where I was drafting with Christian Calcano. And he described the same thing, where he's just sort of at certain stages going with his gut. And I started embracing that immediately. So whenever I'm deciding between two picks, even if a pick order that is well known would suggest one way, I just look at the two cards and what does my gut tell me to take? I'm not going to question it. I'm going to take it because that's going to align more with what I want to do. And that really has improved my drafting skills.
Yeah, I also want to tack on here, like, I think, you know, for our Beard episode, I think that was a pretty iconic episode for figuring out the Ixalan format. And a lot of that was you and Ahead Dude, like, relaying information to us and us packaging it very neatly in the Beard philosophy. So how, and I think that's a strength of both of yours, is, like, figuring out what's good in a format. Like, how do you, like, what, how does that work for you? Like, when you sit down to play a new format?
So you mean, like, when a new format starts, just so I understand the question, how am I approaching it to try and figure out what's good that people might not think is good?
Yeah.
So the first thing that I really try and do is understanding the way that all of the commons interact. One of the first things I noticed about this format was how clunky the removal was. And once I identified that as something about the format, I realized that, well, as per usual, people may be picking removal highly, right? I think at the beginning of the format, a lot of people weren't unhappy to first pick the card Unfriendly Fire.
Yes, myself included.
Yeah, and now that we know a lot about the format, it's hard to imagine first picking Unfriendly Fire. And this was something that I was able to identify early by just looking at all the cards. You realize that the creatures, they're not that great. I think when you really look at all the commons in this set, you realize that everything's kind of like a 2-2 and a 3-3.
Yeah, even from 2 mana to 5 mana.
Yeah, exactly. That's why the card Grazing Whiptail has so overperformed. Mm-hmm. It's just like a 3-4 reach just sort of dominates a battlefield. And when you realize all of that plus clunky removal, well, then things like One with the Wind do go up in value because people aren't going to necessarily be able to kill it so early since the removal is expensive. And also, because the removal is clunky and not good, you're not going to play against a deck that's chock full of removal either.
It also makes cheap combat tricks like Sure Strike and Vampire Zeal. Yes. So, like, they are basically removal in the format. You know, LSV is called Vampire Zeal Swords to Plowshares multiple times. Like, mm-hmm. And he's not wrong. Like, getting those cheap combat tricks as essentially cheap removal is a really big shift for this format, I think.
Absolutely. So the one thing that I say that I would do differently, that I would really advocate for, that a lot of people don't, is when you start drafting a format, I pay more attention to my opponent's decks than I do mine.
Ooh, interesting.
I'm drafting the way that I want to draft. I'm usually trying to figure things out. So at the beginning of this format, I had an inkling that One with the Wind was going to be good because of the way that I looked at the commons. And because people didn't think it was good, I would always get it. And then I really learned quickly how good the card was. But for example, Dive Down, I completely dismissed. Yet it wasn't too long before my opponents started getting me with Dive Down. I would play a Pious Interdiction and they would just counter it for 1 mana. And I would play it before combat and now their thing has +3 toughness and I couldn't attack anymore either. And I really advocate for, if you think you are losing to a bad card, don't dismiss it as, oh, my opponent put this bad card in their deck. Instead, ask yourself why that card beat you. And when you do that, you can assess maybe in this specific format, that card's not a bad card. And it really gets you to reassess evaluations quickly, because if you only assess the cards that you have access to through your draft, that's substantially less than all of the opponents you play against in any given draft. So the whole point is that when you're playing against people, it's data. And the more data that you get, the quicker you can get to the point where you fully understand a format.
Yes, I remember a specific interaction with you very early on in the format where we were talking about Pirate's Cutlass. I had identified that Pirates, like, it took me a little bit to get on the Pirate's Cutlass train, longer than it should have probably. And I was playing and I lost to Pirate's Cutlass, like, several times. Like, and I had identified that card was the reason that I lost the matchups, but I didn't make the leap to, like, maybe I should be picking Pirate's Cutlass higher if this is the card I keep losing to. And you and exactly. I were talking about that and you pointed that out. And that I think is a big takeaway from me, from my interactions with you and from this format, like that I'm going to try to pay more attention to what's causing me to lose and be much more willing to reevaluate my pick orders.
Now, when you are looking at a new set like Ixalan and you come to these conclusions like the Beard philosophy, like taking One with the Wind and Pirate's Cutlass highly, and that removal is clunky and combat tricks are perhaps replacing removal, how does that then translate to your evaluation of the next set? Are there takeaways? Do you now just go like, oh, like a card like Pirate's Cutlass in this set is good, so it's going to be good in future sets as well?
That's a really good question. So every set sort of provides a new outlook on Limited. You know, if you pay attention to the last couple of years, auras are getting slightly better. And about 5 years ago, maybe, removal was efficient and auras weren't as good. And now that the removal gets clunkier, they get better. And so each set provides a new aspect, a new way of thinking about Limited. And I do try and take that to the next one, although it's important not to take it too strongly. A lot of almost everything in Magic isn't black and white. Too many people treat it as black and white, as we've already said. And I definitely think about it in more fluid terms. And so I don't say, oh, well, One with the Wind was good here. That doesn't mean that when we go into the next set, Rivals of Ixalan, that in Pack 3 you should be taking One with the Wind highly. It might be bad now. But I have seen a window where the card is good, and it increases my ability to evaluate that card. Because we've had, I think, the exact same card in Innistrad, right? Spectral Flight.
Yeah.
Which was not that great. I mean, it was a playable card with certain other cards. But now we have it as, where at least I have it as, the best blue common and one of the best commons. And it has to do with the different environments. You put the same card in two different environments and you get drastically different outcomes. And the more times you see it, the more of a feel you'll get for how good the card is where. It's hard to really identify what exactly about the cards in the environment make it that way, other than playing with them, which is why the first week of a format is always so intriguing, because you've seen similar cards before, and now you just have to put them in place with what they're surrounded by. I don't think there's a hard rule that I can say for taking what you've learned from one set and going to the other, other than just being more open-minded.
Yes, that's a very big takeaway from my interactions with you, is how willing you are to listen to why somebody's put a card in their deck and whether or not it's right for them. And I think what you were just talking about there, like in the context of environments, for example, like the card Pounce in this format, I do think that's one of the reasons, like pulling information from old things, that I was able to peg in the set review that wasn't great, because I just kind of historically, fight cards have overperformed when they give power and toughness boosts and underperform when they haven't.
Yes.
So that led me to, well, Pounce probably isn't going to be great, so I'm not going to take it super highly. And then it ended up being even worse, I think, than I thought it was going to be. But just, I think you need to keep in mind what the effect is and the context, like the draft environment that it was in, and see if those things match up in the new format, right? Because there's only so many. There's going to be aggro formats, there's going to be control formats, there's going to be mid-range formats. So there's a limited number of contexts. Like, each format's different, but there's going to be recurring themes throughout, like recurring generalities.
Absolutely.
So we will get into the roundtable discussion in just a bit. We've got a couple interesting drafts to get to. But before that, I wanted to get a sense of what your personal preference is, Ryan. What sorts of things you gravitate towards in a draft or gameplay, how you feel you play to your own strengths.
Sure. So I lean towards aggressive decks, that's for sure. I do enjoy my dirtling and controlling decks, for sure. But I think that, especially towards my strength in the game, I would say that my biggest strength in technical play is doing combat over multiple turns. So there's a great way of thinking about it, actually, where if you ever lose by going to exactly zero, right, exactly zero, it's more likely than not that your opponent figured that out a couple turns ago.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, that they were playing the game to this point. Maybe they made a weird attack. Maybe they did something. Maybe they made a suicide attack 3 turns ago that made no sense to you. And then you lose by going to exactly zero because they had a one with the wind in their hand. And they could see over a couple turns that it didn't matter what you do. If I get you to this life total, I can slam this one with the winds and that's it. And so that's something that I'm really good at. And so that tends to reward aggressive decks more because you get to play with your opponent's life total. And you get to think in this sort of way. A lot of people were complaining in Amonkhet that it was too fast. You often died by turn 4, turn 5, and there weren't that many decisions. But if you played the really aggressive decks in that format, on turn 2, you had like 4 or 5 decisions. And if you played the wrong 2-drop, you could lose the game because your deck doesn't have staying power, right? After turn 6, if your opponent isn't an aggressive deck, it's going to be way harder for you to win. And so understanding how to sequence aggressive plays to maximize damage over a couple turns is something that I'm good at, and I know that. And so I have a preference towards drafting cards that help me do that. It's one of the reasons why I love One with the Wind, for exactly the example that I gave.
That's so interesting that you brought up red-white, or like just aggro decks in Amonkhet, because I remember one of the first times I was watching Ben's stream way, way back in the day, he had Master Jareth Skyping in, and you guys had drafted some red-white aggro deck, and I think it was exactly on turn 2, both of you were remarking, like, wow, there are, like, more decisions in this deck than we've seen in, like, any other deck we've drafted. You know, like, which 2-drop do you play? Because you're going to pick that card for this turn, and then does that mean you're going to go 2-drop, 1-drop cartouche on turn 3, or are you going to go a different 2-drop, 1-drop? Like, there's so many sequencing things in those aggressive decks in the earlier turns that you might take for granted.
Right, and one of the things that I think people miss, a lot of people say that they view themselves as a good player, and they want to play a deck that goes towards the long game to maximize the number of interactions and decisions so that they can outplay their opponent.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't think there are less decisions in aggressive decks. They're just compounded, right? You have more decisions on the earlier turns. And if you make the wrong ones, it's way more punishing. It's harder to come back because you don't have so many cards that yield 2-for-1s and can overtake your opponent. But this specific sequencing and taking the correct decisions from turns 1 through 4 you know, you have like six decisions per turn. And sure, the game might be over on turn five or six, but it probably equals something similar to the amount of decisions made till turn, you know, 10 in a more mid-range normal limited deck.
Yeah, for sure.
I have a very important question for you, Ryan.
Sure.
Do you enjoy playing mono red in Vintage Cube?
Oh, no.
Not as much as you would think per this discussion.
Oh, that's interesting. I was ready to pile on.
We were going
to
cut the call right there, right?
Yeah.
We were going to proceed with just us in the episode.
I do play mono red when it's open, but for me, Vintage Cube, I actually view as more of like a, how do I put this? I think Vintage Cube is a really good, you know, tool for exercising creativity. This sort of thing that we're talking about with looking at a format and trying to figure out what to do with it. I really enjoy trying to do quirky things in Cube, finding little interactions or archetypes that might not exist. And so I often spend time trying to do that. Because of that, I don't end up drafting mono red. I do enjoy it when I play it, I'll say that, but I don't draft it that much.
I think Vintage Cube or cubes in general are the best playgrounds for figuring out your own preferences.
Yeah.
Because there's no format where like power level is like out the window because everything is so powerful. And so it just really comes down to like your own preferences. Like you can see, well, these like four picks are probably the pick in this pack, but what do I want to play with? What am I going to feel comfortable with? What do I enjoy doing? Because the more you enjoy it, the more you are going to be focused and the better you're going to be at playing with the deck, you know? I just think Cube is such a great instructing tool for figuring out your own preferences.
And also just like deck building too, right? Like
you
have to draft a deck. Like you have to make discipline picks and like pick mana dorks over dragons, and you have to like, you really have to draft a deck. I think that's the number one thing that's going to bump your win rate up in a cube if you're new to cube or struggling. You just gotta, like, if you just sat down and say, I want to draft a control deck, or I want to draft a green red aggro deck, and you try to take, like, you're probably not going to get cut because all the cards are so busted. Like, if you just draft a deck, you're probably going to do well too.
I think that can even be applied to Ixalan drafts as well. I mean, people seem to have written this format off a long time ago. We've talked about it a lot. I feel like we're Ixalan apologists on this show, but I think that picks coming down to like Stormfleet Spy versus Water Trap Weaver, right? They're both 2-mana 2/2 or 3-mana 2/2s in blue, but like depending on where your deck is going, one of those cards is going to be strictly better than the other one. Depending on if you are aggressive, care about pirate synergies, you're going to want the Spy. Depending if you have Merfolk synergies and are aggressive, you may want the Water Trap Weaver. If you are defensive, you're definitely going to want the Water Trap Weaver over the Stormfleet Spy. Like, there are a lot of different things to think about rather than just like raw power level of like which is better in a vacuum, because that's not actually helpful.
Yeah, I agree. I actually think you can even extrapolate broader than that. And this is one of the reasons why preferences is something that I really feel strongly about towards upping your limited game. I think regardless of the limited format, you can approach it similarly to the way that you would approach Cube, in the sense that you can sit down and say, all right, what do I want to do? Now, you can't, unlike Cube, you can't say, I'm going to force mono red, because you can sort of do that in Cube where it's like, I'm going to be blue-white control. And because all of the cards are all so good, it doesn't really matter. You'll be able to put something together, and you can't be that harsh in most limited sets, but you can bias yourself towards what you want to do, and it may not be the best thing to do. I'm not trying to say you should force, but I think it's a good exercise. Often, especially late in the format, and I think I was on one of your streams saying this, I'll go into a draft saying, okay, what do I feel like doing? Let's design an archetype around it. And instead of saying, oh, I'm going to be blue-red, you say, okay, well, maybe I want to make the card Makeshift Munitions work. All right, what are the different color combinations and cards that go up in value? Can I come up with 4 or 5 different kinds of decks that can utilize this card to good ability? And then if I bias my drafting and I change the weights of the different cards such that should I see the card Makeshift Munitions, I should be able to maximize how good it is. And maybe if I don't, I still end up with a good deck. You can certainly draft that way in any format.
Well, I can't think of a better way to transition into our roundtable than that. So we're going to look at a couple Ixalan drafts that you've got for us here, Ben, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, these are drafts that I did that we're going to take through here and see how close our preferences align. All right, so we're starting off cards in contention in our first pack here. A Legion Conquistador, 2 and a white for the 2/2 vampire that when it enters the battlefield, you can search up any other number of Legion Conquistadors. Dive Down, single blue for the instant. Target creature you control gets +0/+3 in hexproof until end of turn. Depths of Desire, 2 and a blue for the instant. Bounce a creature and create a treasure token. Tempest Caller, 2 blue-blue for a 2/3 when it enters the battlefield. Tap all creatures target opponent controls. Raptor Hatchling, 1 and a red for the 1/1 dinosaur. When it is dealt damage, you create a 3/3 green dinosaur creature token with trample. And Grim Captain's Call, 2 and a black, sorcery, return one of each of the 4 creature types, one of each of the 4 tribes to your hand.
Ryan, what do you think about this pack?
Well, usually I'd like to have some better options to start off a draft, I'll say that. But the interesting thing about this pack is that out of all those options, certain things like, I don't even see Grim Captain's Call. And that's just because like in the decks that I draft, it's just almost never playable. Not saying it's not playable in some decks, but I'm just not likely to end up there. Out of all of these cards, I just want to take the one with the highest ceiling. So I'd probably be on Tempest Caller just because it has the highest ceiling out of all of them. It's the least replaceable. After that, I know this might sound crazy. I might actually be on Dive Down.
Ooh, I like that.
Dive Down's great.
I have found more and more in decks when I do end up in the beard strategies these days that all I want, I just desperately want to Dive Down and I can't get them. Like I used to be cutting them. I used to have Siren Storm Tamers and Dive Downs galore to protect my suited up creatures. And now that just is not as likely as it was before. But I don't know if I'd be willing to first pick it here. I'm eyeing that Depths of Desire, guys. You know, it says it makes it makes a treasure. You know what treasures let you do is just splish splash around.
They do.
So I don't know. I'm not crazy about Tempest Caller. I feel like I agree it has the highest ceiling, but it also is a very narrow card, and I feel like I would be moving off of Tempest Caller more often than not by first picking it. But I don't know. I can't fault you for it, and I also feel like I want to be a little contrarian, so I think I would be on Depths of Desire here.
I ended up on Tempest Caller for the same reasons Ryan listed. I thought it was just the highest power level card in the pack, but Depths of Desire makes sense to me. Moving onwards to pack 1, pick 2. Cards you see that are in contention. There's a Bishop Soldier, 1 and a white for the 2/2 Lifelinker. Shapers of Nature, 1 blue-green for the 3/3 Merfolk Shaman. It's got 2 activated abilities, 3 and a green, put a +1/+1 counter onto a creature. 2 and a blue, remove a +1/+1 counter from a creature to draw a card. And you see Lightning Rig Crew, 2 and a red for the 0/5 Goblin Pirate. And you can tap to deal 1 damage to each opponent, and when you cast a pirate spell, it untaps.
I think with Ryan on the podcast, we also have to mention that Swashbuckling is in the pack.
Oh my god. Get for the aura. That is not
enchanted creature gets +2/+2 and has haste.
I may have been looking at it.
So with your Tempest Caller, where are you at in this pack?
I think, you know, Shapers of Nature is such a good Magic card. There's a lack of mana sinks in this format, and it's one of the best ones. The things that I'm looking at in this pack are Shapers of Nature or Bishop Soldier. I love Bishop Soldier. That card, it's just, you know, there's the groan test, right? Anytime someone casts that card on turn 2 against me, I groan.
Yeah.
It's just such, you just have to drudge through it. And that card's just unbelievably good. And I really like blue-white. But if the person to my right is paying attention to what they're sending, they might be noting, okay, I passed the Shapers of Nature, so someone next to me is going to try and be Merfolk, so maybe I should avoid it. And if that happens, you can get really rewarded, because Merfolk, if you're the only drafter at the table, is a real good deck. So I think I'd just follow up my Tempest Caller, which is a Merfolk, with the Merfolk Gold Uncommon.
Yeah, I think it was you early in the format or early in your introducing me to the beard philosophy. You mentioned that you thought Shapers of Nature was not great in green blue. That it's a 3 mana 3/3, which is great. It's sort of like above rate in this format, but that the activated abilities don't often come up because Merfolk is such an aggressive deck. Maybe there's like a bit of threat of activation there, but you're not really going off with Shapers of Nature in a Merfolk deck, or at least that's been my experience. Do you guys feel differently?
It doesn't take over the game in the same way that it does in like these decks that I see you drafting on stream.
Mm-hmm.
But the threat of activation is real. The card's really good.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of times where I've had situations in pack 3 where I've taken a River Herald's Boon over it, or a One with the Winds over it. You know, there are certain cards that have a little bit more of a punch when you're in the aggressive Merfolk deck, One thing to note, though, is in pack one, it's so important to find the right lane that taking the gold uncommon, you know, so that there's less of a chance that the person, that someone downstream from you will take it, does also have value. You know, it's not like, I think the card's overrated. I do believe that, but it's still very good.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm taking Shapers of Nature here, no contest, but especially with either one of the blue cards, Tempest Caller or Depths of Desire in my pile, I'm definitely slamming the Shapers here.
Yep, that's what I did as well. Moving on to pack one, pick three, you see the following cards in contention. Territorial Hammerskull, 2 and a white for 2/3. When it attacks, tap target creature and opponent controls. Run Aground, 3 and a blue, instant speed, put target artifact or creature on top of its owner's library. Prosperous Pirates Ethan, 4 and a blue for a 3/4, enters the battlefield, you make 2 treasure. There's another Tempest Caller, there's a Lookout's Dispersal, 2 and a blue for an instant. It costs 1 less to cast if you control a pirate, and you counter target spell unless they pay 4. And our rare, got a spicy one, Growing Rights of Itlamok, 2 and a green for the legendary enchantment. When it enters the battlefield, put the top 4 cards. Good lord, that's too small. I can't even read that over here.
Ben, I could do it from memory. You're a disgrace.
I've never cast this card.
It's a vintage cube-worthy card, you guys.
It really is. All right, so why don't you just tell the listeners what it does? I give up. This is
all right, guys,
too small.
Growing Rights of Itlamok, 2 and a green, legendary enchantment. When it enters the battlefield, you look at the top 4 cards of your library. You may reveal a creature card from among them, put it into your hand, put the rest on the bottom of your library in any order. At the beginning of your end step, if you control 4 or more creatures, you flip it. I actually don't know what his card. It's like Itlamok, the Growing Spring or something. It's a legendary land. It taps for a green mana, or it taps for a green mana for each creature you control.
Yep, you can tell by my familiarity with that card that it was not my pick.
That is insane. All right, Ryan, what do you think about this pack? We got a lot of different choices here, I think.
Oh, yeah, there's some stuff in this pack. I think that Territorial Hammerskull is one of the best cards in the entire format, and this also showcases my preference towards aggressive decks, right? If you know that you don't end up in aggressive decks often, you're still going to be high on Hammerskull, just maybe not as high as I am, whereas I almost always end up in a deck that wants to be attacking. And even though, yes, I went blue card into blue-green card, blue-white is still fine, and even just white anything. I think it's important to actually note about this pack that 2 commons are missing. And so there aren't many. I mean, like Cutlass I would take over Hammerskull, and I would take one with the wins over it, but I don't think the rest of the world would. And so I think that there's a, I mean, the people next to me could have taken a foil, but a Hammerskull pick 3 with all commons missing is, you know, it raises a bell in my head of, okay, maybe white's going to flow. And that combined with it being just a great card is, it's certainly what I'm going to pick here.
That's interesting. I would assume with Tempest Caller into Shapers of Nature that you would be on Tempest Caller here. Do you not like them in multiples, or you just think Hammerskull is that much of a signal?
So it's sort of a combination of both. I mean, having access to multiple Tempest Callers is definitely a thing. But depending on the different decks that you get, it might not be necessary, right? Let's say you get one with the winds and stuff, and Jade Guardian's probably just going to be better in that slot now. And there are only so many 4-drops you can play when you end up in the Merfolk deck or any, you know, aggressive deck that is going to try and abuse Tempest Caller. And I think if you play it in the non-aggressive decks, you don't want multiples. So I'm not really on taking the second Tempest Caller here, especially this early in the draft.
Makes sense. Ben, where were you at in this pack?
I was struggling in this pack. I really wanted to stay on the blue-green plan for a little bit. I wasn't quite willing to branch out for Hammerskull here. And I was torn between... I also didn't want a second Tempest Caller. I was torn between Lookout's Dispersal and Run Aground. And I ended up settling on Lookout's Dispersal because it's like 1 mana cheaper, and like Merfolk a lot of times wants to play a tempo game. I think it's just probably a better card than Run Aground. It was really close for me, though.
But in Merfolk, is it better than Cancel, which is in the pack?
I think it is.
It's easier to cast.
I think that's huge. So for counter target spell, unless its controller pays 4, is almost always Cancel.
Almost.
Almost. Sometimes it's not, but the being able to cast it early, consistently, especially because sometimes the Merfolk decks really have to lean green for the 1-drop slot if you get Kumena's Speakers, Jungle Delvers, and so on, that the double blue can be an issue because you often want to be playing 16 lands with a 9/7 mana base with 9 green, 7 blue. And that really makes Cancel struggle a bit more.
Wow, you're really thinking like 18 steps ahead there. That's, I really, really like that. I think I mean, it's clear from my rote memory of what the text of the card is that I'm taking Growing Rights of Itlamok. And I want to defend that pick because I think it's probably, like, not correct, quote-unquote. But my experience with the decks that I like to draft, which are, like, sort of the Sultai-based control decks, the things that are hard to get for that deck are Mana Sinks, and the two that I talk about all the time are Shapers of Nature and Thundering Spineback, and we already have a Shapers of Nature in the pile. And Growing Rights of Itlamok goes so well with those Mana Sinks because you're able to just, like, dump a bunch of mana into either making counters for your creatures or drawing cards or making dinos with the Spineback, that I think Growing Rights is a really good card. And I think I'm going to wheel a Dirtle card out of this pack. Like, there's so many blue cards. I think Prosperous Pirates is coming around.
Yeah, you could be set up to go off.
For sure.
All right, moving on to pack one, pick four. You see the following cards as options. Shipwreck Looter, one and a blue for a 2/1. Human Pirate, when it enters the battlefield, if you attacked, you get to loot. New Horizons, two and a green for the enchant land. When it enters the battlefield, put a +1/+1 counter on a creature you control, and the land can tap for 2 mana of any one color. There's another Depths of Desire, another Lightning Rig Crew, and I think that's about it that's in contention here.
What do you like out of this pack, Ryan? Probably nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the options that I have here, but that happens sometimes. That's just the way that the packs roll. For me, in what I have currently, in the way that I've drafted, right, which would be Tempest Caller into Shapers of Nature into Hammer Skull, I think I'm almost certainly taking a blue card. Lightning Rig Crew is probably the best card in the pack, but to be honest, I've gone down on the card. I was really high on it at the beginning of the format, but now it's just, it's okay, it's fine. It does its job, but it's not really a card that makes me want to branch out into another color at this point. So what I'm looking at is Depths of Desire and Shipwreck Looter. I think that either are defensible. I would probably be taking Depths here for two reasons, and this has to do with how I like to draft these kinds of decks. Given what I have, I'm trying to either go blue-white or go towards Merfolk, right? And in Merfolk, there are plenty of 2-drops, and Shipwreck Looter would not be one of the best, and I don't really want to pick it up that early. And specifically for blue-white, one of the things that I've had a lot of success with, actually, is splashing for Anointed Deacon, which you can usually pick up because it's a common at some point, unless there are multiple vampire drafters at the table. And so having access to a couple of tempo cards that do make treasures, things like Depths of Desire, can be really important. So I believe that's what I'm on here.
That's interesting. I would think that you would find the bounce spells replaceable because there's also Run Aground and Perilous Voyage available to you in the common and uncommon level. But that makes a lot of sense to me that you value the treasure making pretty highly over grabbing a random 2-mana 2/1.
Mm-hmm. I actually value Depths of Desire, the first copy at least, better than both of those other cards for exactly that reason.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just taking New Horizons over Depths here so that I can cement myself in some sort of green, splashing, ramping nonsense deck.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like I'm halfway, like if we're talking about preferences, I feel like I'm halfway in between the two of you. Like, I'm fine playing an aggro deck, I'm fine playing a control deck, but as we found out recently, I'm not really a true lover of the Dirtle.
No.
But I did hedge here a little bit, and I ended up settling on New Horizons because I know that goes very well with Shapers of Nature in the Dirtle ramp control decks. And I figured I probably wasn't going to miss Shipwreck Looter in a Merfolk deck. So I settled on New Horizons there as well.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, for me at least, looking at this pack, I don't even see the New Horizons really. I understand that it's an option, but...
You're just off green, right?
Yeah, it's just not... I very rarely end up in a green deck that can abuse New Horizons. That's not to say that I don't end up in non-aggro decks. Sometimes I end up in a mid-range or control deck. It's just not green.
All right, one more pick here. We got pack one, pick five. You've really just got two choices here. You're trying to decide, but I think it's an interesting choice. You're trying to decide between a Shaper Apprentice, one and a blue for the 2/1 that has flying when you control another Merfolk, and River Herald's Boon, one and a green for the instant, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature and target Merfolk.
This is really close, at least for me, right? Because I'm right now I have a white card, a blue-green card, and 2 blue cards, and, you know, I could be staying open, right, with the Shaper Apprentice, because it can go in both decks. I already have a Merfolk for the in Tempest Caller if I end up blue-white, and, you know, you'll play Water Trap Weavers and other Shaper Apprentices and so on, so it's actually a fine card in those kinds of decks. But River Herald's Boon is going to be one of the best cards in the blue-green deck, and I think it's worth more to, even if I don't end up blue-green, not sending the signal that blue-green is open by giving the person to my left a 6th pick River Herald's Boon, and I would just hedge with it.
I mean, I'm going to take Ravenous Daggertooth, the card that we didn't even talk
not,
about.
Not even an option here.
Not even an option.
Not even a choice. Dirtle at the window here for me once I saw this pick. It was very close for me also, Ryan, and I ended up settling on the Shaper Apprentice because I wanted to hedge. I don't know. I didn't know if I was going to end up in exactly Merfolk, and I figured if I didn't end up in exactly Merfolk, the Shaper Apprentice was going to be better. But I think, like, in hindsight, River Herald's Boon, probably the correct pick. It ended up, like, being results-oriented, turning out to be very correct. The rest of this draft, I settled in a Merfolk, got another Shaper Apprentice, an Old Growth Dryads that I did play and cast, and then a Juggle Delver to dive down, and we just blue-green Merfolk from there. And I ended up with a very good deck.
Did you live the dream, Old Growth Dryads into one with the wind?
I did not, I don't think. Maybe? I don't remember.
I've done that. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I still never did that. Probably never will. Rip the dream.
Yeah, so, and we were just talking about, you were on stream the other day, talking about cards that we'd played and hadn't played. So I guess showcasing our preferences here a little bit, I have never cast Growing Rites of Iklamok, and you've never cast Old Growth Dryads.
Yeah, that's very true. That really does showcase our preferences. I have played it in a deck, but I just never got to cast it.
Yeah, it's funny, because Old Growth Dryads is not a good Magic card, right? I've had my opponents cast it against me, and it's the only reason I won those matches. But I have also put it in my deck. I don't think it's actually a one-drop when you do play it. It's a one-drop if you can follow it up with one with wins. Other than that, its purpose is mostly like double spelling on turn four with a three-drop plus a 3/3. Mm-hmm. Also, that way they can't utilize the land as well. It's not a great card. I have played it. I've only ever put it in my deck if I had multiple copies of One with the Wind, though.
That makes total sense.
We've also got another pack here we want to take a look at. This is a stacked pack for sure. Pack one, pick one. You see the following options. Vanquish the Weak, two and a black, instant speed, destroy target creature, power three or less. Pirate's Cutlass, three mana for the equipment. Equip cost of two. Equip creature gets +2/+1, and when it enters the battlefield, put it on a pirate. Deeproot Warrior, one and a green for the 2/2 merfolk. Then when it gets blocked, it gets +1/+1. Anointed Deacon, four and a black for the 3/3 vampire. At the beginning of combat on your turn, you can give another vampire or itself +2/+0 until end of turn. Savage Stomp, two and a green for the sorcery. Cost two less to cast if it's targeting a dinosaur you control. Put a +1/+1 counter on target creature you control. Then it fights another creature. Fathom Fleet Captain is our rare, one and a black for the 2/1 human pirate with menace, and when it attacks, if you control another non-token pirate, you can pay two. If you do, create a 2/2 black pirate token with menace.
Yeesh.
Wow, this pack is good. For me, I think I quickly narrow it down between Fathom Fleet Captain and Pirate's Cutlass. Savage Stomp is one of the green cards I am willing to first pick, so I very rarely end up in green, so even though I know that the card's good, I have to weight it less, right? I have to say that even though the card's great, I have to treat it as if it's not as great because it has a higher chance of ending up in my sideboard than any of the other cards in the pack. And so after checking the rest of the cards, I see that there are cards that I view as better. And so I'm looking at Fathom Fleet Captain and Pirate's Cutlass, which I think is pretty close. Cutlass almost always makes my deck and it's always great, but Captain can just take over the game completely by itself. Even if you end up in vampires and have like maybe one other pirate or whatever, a 2-mana 2/1 menace, you know, it's not as good in vampires because those decks can play the long game, but just a 2-mana 2/1 menace is always solid. And when you play it, your opponent kind of has to handle it if they, you know, don't know that you might not have that many other pirates to start. And I think that's where I would end.
That's interesting. My experience has been different with Fathom Fleet Captain, and I've found it to really be only good in a black-blue or a black-red deck. I've been pretty underwhelmed by it in vampire decks. So it leads me to the question of, like, is Fathom Fleet Captain as pigeonhole-y as maybe Anointed Deacon is, or do we think it leaves you a bit more open?
I think, for me, it's not necessarily that it leaves you more open. I mean, I play Anointed Deacon in blue-black, especially if I have one with the winds. Seven power in the air is nothing to scoff at.
Right.
But I think that at least for the decks that I draft, almost all of them would just play the card 2-mana 2/1 menace. Two drops are at a premium. There's not really a cap in this format of the two drops you would play. This one has the chance to be the best card in your deck should you end up with enough pirates. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm willing to take the risk of not playing it for that ceiling.
I think there's also something to be said about, like, taking Cutlass and passing Captain, Deacon, and Vanquish the Weak. And letting some people to your left fight over black. Or is that's something that I think about? I don't know if I'm leveling myself. I don't know what you guys think.
It's relevant for sure that you could be pushing people into black. When I do that, I don't necessarily avoid black per se. I think that that's where people can make mistakes where they're like, oh, I'm passing like three good black cards, so I just shouldn't be black. Whereas if you can be black, and so can someone to your left, as long as you're not, you know, your black-white vampires and their black-white vampires or something like that. But it's definitely relevant and would, you know, I would use as a tie-breaking rule. If I'm deciding, if I take Cutlass and the next pick is between like a black card and a blue card and it's close, I'll probably just take the blue card.
Right. So I actually ended up on Fathom Fleet Captain here, I think incorrectly. Like I picked it and then I had a little why me moment. And I was wishing I'd taken Pirate's Cutlass. I think Pirate's Cutlass is probably, I don't know, felt to me after I took Fathom Fleet Captain, felt like the objectively correct pick. But this was a super interesting, super hard first pick. And I think on power level, Savage Taunt might be the best card in the pack.
It's certainly very, very strong. It's certainly up there for me.
You know, actually, another thing to think about is think about just what the black decks are in this format.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Most of the black-green decks are these hyper-dirtle ramp Esh decks where Fathom Fleet Captain's not going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
And Cutlass is certainly much better in black-white. And then in black-red and black-blue, where most of your cards are pirates,
mm-hmm.
Or, you know, sometimes that's the case, Captain is probably going to be better than Cutlass because it can just completely take over the game. But Cutlass is also going to be absurd in those decks. So it's an interesting thought. And it's why I think this pick is so close. There's like one deck, right? So there are three decks that you'll play it in, or you might, I guess, not play it in black-white, depending on your version. And that third deck, Cutlass is going to be very good in.
Yeah, I think in the decks where Fathom Fleet Captain's good, Pirate's Cutlass is just great also. And like, you're 100% to play Pirate's Cutlass, right? Almost. Like, probably like 90-95% to put Pirate's Cutlass in your deck. So I think Pirate's Cutlass is probably the pick. All right, moving on to pick two. You see the following options. Another good pack. Territorial Hammerskull. Two and a white for the 2/3 that taps something down. Contract Killing, 3BB, destroy target creature, make 2 treasure tokens. Call to the Feast, 2WB, create 3/1/1 bite white vampire creature tokens with lifelink. I think those are the three standout cards in the pack.
Yeah, I agree. I have a feeling we're not going to have much to discuss here. If I'm taking Hammerskull, Ryan has to be taking Hammerskull, right?
That would be correct.
Okay.
And I also slammed Hammerskull there. Moving on to pick three. This is where it gets a little more interesting. You see the following options. Water Trap Weaver, 2BB for the 2/2. When it enters the battlefield, tap something down. It doesn't untap during its controller's next untap step. There's a Vampire Zeal, single white, instant speed. Target creature gets +2/+2. If it was a vamp, it gains first strike. Anointed Deacon, 4BB for the 3/3 vamp. The beginning of combat, you give target vampire +2/+0. And I think those are really the only three cards that stand out to me here.
I think Tempest Caller is worth mentioning, though I'm not sure any of us would take it here.
I just think Water Trap Weaver is a better card than Tempest Caller.
Yeah, I do too, but I don't know if people out there do. Where are you at on this pick, Ryan?
I think I'm actually on Water Trap Weaver here. And so it's, again, I love Deacon, and it's great in black-white. And as I said in the previous draft, it can be great in blue-white. But I think that Weaver, I tend to actually like being in multiple different colors to start my drafts in this format. I want to leave myself the most possible lanes to explore should something be open. And I think taking Water Trap Weaver, what it does is it says, okay, I can pair it with this Hammer Skull for a great blue-white deck. I can pair it with this Fathom Fleet Captain for a great blue-black deck. Or, hey, maybe the next pack is going to have Shapers of Nature or a River Herald's Boon and not much else. And I can potentially even be Merfolk. And find the right lane. So for me, I think that Water Trap Weaver is like on power level with Deacon. They're both very good cards, but Weaver leaves me the most possible lanes to explore the best deck.
Yeah, we've talked about that on the podcast, like the fact that in this format, I kind of actively want to be in multiple colors, like have my, I think it's almost better to have your first three picks spread across three colors because it leaves you so much more flexible than if you go like vampire, 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 and then vampires gets cut.
That's so true. I really like Water Trap Weaver, and I agree with this like idea of being in multiple colors, but I think there's a real argument for if you did go Cutlass Hammer Skull to take Zeal here. I think I'm not taking Zeal as high as I should be, even 200 drafts deep. Just the card is consistently a blowout and consistently impressive to me. And as we talked about, the removal is clunky and this is essentially removal. That I wonder if it's just like, I really want to play Hammerskull because it's one of the best cards in the format. I want to like pick up on white if I can, so I would take Zeal. I think I would probably fold and take Water Trap Weaver just because it also leaves me open. And if I do end up in blue white, I'm probably going to rather have a Water Trap Weaver than a Zeal anyway, depending on how the deck shakes out. But I think it's pretty close.
Yeah, I took neither of those cards. I ended up on Anointed Deacon here. I already had a black card and a white card I wanted to play. We'd seen Call to the Feast passed, and then I saw this Anointed Deacon, which was making me think that maybe Vampires was open. So I took Deacon here, and I was looking to draft Vampires. Next pick, I think that's probably all the really interesting picks here.
I
snapped up a Pious Interdiction and then some Paladins of the Bloodstain, and I actually ended up in a black-white kind of non-vamps deck. It was like medium vamps, more black-white grindy than anything else.
Nice.
But yeah, the start of that draft was super, super interesting. Lots of different directions you could go in.
And they say Ixalan is a boring format. Get out of here. So we want to look to be wrapping up this show in just a little bit, but I wanted to talk a little bit about your philosophy in reviewing drafts or games, because that's something you bring up a lot when you're in my Twitch chat, Ryan, of like, oh, this might be an interesting game to go back and look at, because I think like turn four was a super interesting decision point. So for people out there looking to improve and level up, and for people like me who are looking to improve and level up, what sorts of things are you looking for when you go to review drafts or games? Like, what sparks that interest in you to go, oh, that's a game I want to go back to look at, and what are you trying to find there?
Sure. So one of the things that I think is maybe not the most important skill, but a very important skill when it comes to playing Magic is identifying turns that are like the crux of the game. Often there will be a couple turns in any game where you're aware that whatever decision you make, you have 4, 3, 5 decisions, whichever one you choose, doesn't matter which one, is going to have a large impact on the outcome of the actual game. And those decisions are often difficult. So reviewing those games, especially, I would really advocate for not reviewing the games alone. I'll Skype in a friend to get outside opinion and so on, to just really look over my game. And I'll go to the turns that I view as, okay, I had a couple decisions here. I made this one, but I want to talk over the other options because I felt that all of these decisions were really going to shape the way that the game turns out. So identifying those key turns and then looking over them in depth when you have time is a really great way to improve.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I never thought about getting that sort of outside opinion of someone to sort of like figure out what they would do in a vacuum or in the dark, like before they know what you did or how what you did spiraled into multiple other decision trees that maybe they wouldn't consider. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, and you'd be really surprised. You might, you know, go to that turn and say, okay, well, I was looking at these three lines, and, you know, you go down the different trees, and then the person that you're talking to about this is like, well, what I would do isn't even one of those three things. Like,
yeah.
Look at this potential option, and you just entirely missed it. And even if that's not necessarily what was correct, it just gets you used to seeing games a little bit broader, because everybody has their own way of playing. Everybody, you know, you're used to playing, right, with yourself. That's how you play Magic. You are in your own head, and you go over the different decisions and what you see, and other people might be seeing different things, and it's always really useful to hear what they would do.
I also think it's worth noting that it is best, for me at least, to wait a couple days before going back to review, because that gives me the best way of being surprised by what I did. Because if I go back and review it as soon as the game is over, I'm unable to separate what I did as being like the quote unquote correct move to do. But if a few days later, I'm often like, oh wait, why did I do that? I definitely should have done this thing instead. So I think a couple days breather, at least for me, is a really refreshing way to see the draft in a new light, or see the game in a new light.
The other thing that I do look at, by the way, with this is usually if near the end of the game, there was a line that I could take, that was playing around cards, right? It's like, oh, if they have Dive Down, I should do this. But if they have, Cancel, I should do this. Or sort of things like that is I'll watch very carefully over the course of the game to see if there was information I could glean on which card that was from the way that my opponent was playing. And when you do this and then you get to the turn where you made that decision, you can see way more clearly that your opponent may have one or the other. There was an example in an Hour of Devastation draft that I was doing, where I went for the kill and my opponent had Sandblast and I lost the game. I had decided, I was like, okay, I'm going to lose this game if it keeps going, so I should just go for it. You know, if they have it, they have it. And when I went and rewatched that game, they had to have it based on the way that they were playing the game, because of a turn that they, on like turn five, they had double spelled in a way that made me think that they couldn't have it, but they couldn't have made that line if they hadn't had it because they had held up Sandblast. I know that is probably hard to follow. and sorry for the audience if it's difficult, but there was a sequence in the early turns that if I had paid attention to how they had held up mana and cast spells, that really made it likely that they had Sandblast. And then later in the game, I could have played to win the game should they have Sandblast, and I didn't.
So rather than having that mentality of like, well, if they have it, they have it, you should have been able to see, like, they definitely have it. How do I win the game with them having it in their
exactly.
hand?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's really good to review games that way as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would just like to add on to, and we keep talking about it, but you should stream, like, I've or send draft videos to friends or have friends over. I've gotten so much better just from streaming and Twitch chat, like, talking about lines. And right. showing me better lines that I didn't even see. Like just last night, it was something stupid with the Signet and plays in the early turns. And I was going to regrow a land. And I was just like, I was considering two options that were both like suboptimal for a third option that I just didn't see. And somebody typed it in Twitch chat and I was like, oh, awesome. That's like way better. I wouldn't have seen it. And like, I think I'm a better Magic player as a result of that.
That sort of stuff is invaluable. And we've said it before, Ryan, but you're on the show now, but you've been a huge help in both Ben and I improving in this format, and especially the Beard episode, like really taking the reins in some of our drafts to see things that we wouldn't normally see. And I'm incredibly grateful for your internet magic friendship.
Well, thank you.
I think our listeners have benefited as well.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're going to look to wrap up the show here. Where can people find you? Where can people get in touch with you, Ryan, and see the great content that you're producing?
So you can find me on Twitter. My handle is at RCSax. I also write twice a week for StarCityGames.com. My articles go up on Tuesdays and Thursdays, although there haven't been in the last 2 weeks because I've been in exams and I took a break, but they should be coming back next week. They're going to be until, I believe, the release or close to that of Rivals. We'll be doing some cube lightning picks where I just have a bunch of different cube packs and options. Nice. And just, you know, shelling all of those out. So that's where you can find my content.
Great. Likewise, you can find me and Ben on Twitter. I am at Lord Tupperware. Ben is at Mr. Metronome. We're also on Twitch, twitch.tv/LordTupperware and twitch.tv/Mr. Metronome. Ben, we got some exciting vintage cube announcements here.
Yeah, we have our vintage cube treasure hunt going on. So here is the achievement list for the vintage cube. Just as a reminder, we published this last week's episode. The first one, win the game with your opponent controlling no permanence. I've already checked that off twice.
Gross.
Infinite loop time walk. Number three, Mindslaver lock your opponent. Already checked that one off. Win the game with storm count 15 plus. Could have checked that one off, but I like was under pressure and melting on stream trying to play storm, so I didn't get it checked off.
I have.
Oh, nice. And number five, turn two and Eldrazi. So those are your five achievements. If you complete all five, you get entered into a giveaway for a draft set of either like Vintage Cube or Rivals of Ixalan, whatever you prefer. And January 15th, I believe, is the end date for the Vintage Cube, so that will be the cutoff for that.
Yeah, for sure. So get at us on Twitter or email us at lordsoflimited@gmail.com. When you post on Twitter, make sure to hashtag VC Treasure Hunt, Vintage Cube Treasure Hunt, and we'll see those and shout them out on Twitter or stream or the podcast, wherever. I have another announcement here. I just appeared on, so Sandball49 is another Twitch streamer, and he started a Magic Life podcast. I am featured on the second episode, so if you want to hear an interview with me, you just like can't get enough of me talking in your ear, go ahead and download that, subscribe to his podcast. The first episode was with another streamer and Irish national champion, Dave Murphy, and the second episode is with yours truly.
If you've got any feedback about the show or any questions, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com. And thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music.
Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you, Ryan, for appearing on the show. And we'll catch you next week for the final episode of Lords of Limited in 2017.
That's so insane. Bye, everybody.